Horace still charms with graceful negligence, and without methods talks us into sense. Will like a friend familiarly convey the truest notions in the easiest way. Those are the words of Alexander Pope, one of many people over the centuries who has been entranced by the poetry of Quintius Horatius Flaccus, the Roman poet better known to us as Horace. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and this is EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. And I'm delighted to welcome as our guest today Professor Llewellyn Morgan, tutorial fellow in classics at Brasenose College, Oxford, and the author of a marvellous, very short introduction to another Roman poet, Ovid, and now he's followed that up with a very short introduction to Horace, and it's equally lucid and magnificent. Now, Llewellyn, you make a very bold claim in this book that Horace has exerted a more tangible influence on lives lived than any other pagan writer from antiquity. That is a bold claim.
It is a bold claim, and it's a claim I do find myself having to defend after writing this book, particularly, you know, having written a similar book about Ovid, who you generally consider might have a more persistent influence. But I think one of the things I discovered when I was thinking about Horace, and in particular thinking about Horace's sort of afterlife, you know, how he's been read since his day, what I discovered was what a remarkably prominent presence he was in all kinds of particularly intellectual circles at certain points. I mean, perhaps particularly during the Enlightenment, but at other points as well. So I think it's, you know, as a claim about the presence, the prominence of a poet in discourse, if you like, in European discourse consistently, I think I can defend it. I think I can.
Well, let's see. But first of all, for our listeners who aren't familiar with Horace, either his life or work, could you give us a brief biography of this figure? Because he comes from a pretty humble background for one who is such a notable figure in European culture.
Yes, indeed. And among all the literary figures of his period, and it's an important period for Roman literature, and there are many significant figures there. But Horace is the one with the most unpromising background from a Roman point of view, is one way of putting it. He's, he tells us himself that he's the son of a former slave. And there have been efforts to sort of play down the significance of that in quite recent scholarship, but I don't think they're very successful. We don't know the details, but it does seem to be the case that his father had been a slave. And in Roman terms, that's an astonishing place to start if you're, as the son of a slave, son of an ex-slave, if you're going to achieve what Horace does achieve. Mm. His father, though, we don't really know anything in detail about his father's economic circumstances as a freedman. But he's clearly very determined to give Horace a good education, give his son a good education.
And he has a fabulous education, doesn't he?
It's as good as any, he says himself, it's what any equestrian or senator's son might get, you know, which is as good as it absolutely gets. And it culminates in a sort of tertiary education, as it were, in Athens. Which is, on the one hand, the place where one should end up if one has an excellent education, but it's a bad time to be there because Marcus Brutus is recruiting for his army to fight Antony and the future Augustus. We're in the The sort of height of the later civil wars here.
So this is about the 40s BC.
Yes, that's right. So about sort of 42 BC. And Horace is in his 20s at this point. And he finds himself fighting on the wrong side, as it were, the defeated side at the Battle of Philippi, which is this kind of huge battle, which really sort of brings what we would describe as the Roman Republic to an end, effectively.
Augustus defeats Brutus.
Yes, indeed. Augustus and Mark Antony in particular, really, at this point, defeats Brutus. So Horace, you know, he's come from being the son of a former slave, brilliant education, and then gets on the wrong side of a battle. He recovers from this. One thing that, you know, we can't say very much about Horace's life in detail at this point, but what shines through is that he manages all the time. He recovers. And he attributes it to his charm. I think we'd attribute it to his raw talent. This is somehow what's been getting him through. At any rate, he comes back to Rome. He gets a job which we describe as a kind of civil servant. Then at some point is adopted by a figure called Mycenas, who is a right-hand man of Augustus, and also a major patron of poets. He and Horace over time actually develop a very, very close relationship. But from that point in the sort of early-ish 30s BC, Horace is supported by the wealth of the Augustan regime to do what he's best at, which is writing poetry. And from then on, we'll talk about this, but he writes in a sort of a series, he writes a series of collections of poetry until his death.
And so despite being on the losing side at Philippi and entering into this really momentous period in Roman history that I suppose ends with the this very decisive engagement at Actium, 31 BC, I think it is, where Augustus defeats Antony. So Augustus is the ascendant figure now, and Mycenas is not related to him, but he's part and parcel of that milieu, of the Augustan milieu. He's his patron, and there's very much a Roman culture of artists, if we call it, like Horace, poets, that they are dependent upon gifts from wealthy and powerful people like Mycenas or Augustus at the very top.
Yes, indeed. So somebody like Horace, when he's no longer a civil servant, he will earn money, he will have earned money as a civil servant. But when he transfers to the patronage of Mycenas, he will have lived a very comfortable life, but a comfortable life supported by gifts from Mycenas, from Augustus. It's we hear about one of those gifts. We hear about his villa in the Sabine country to the east of Rome. We don't consistently hear of these kinds of gifts because it's a little bit infradig to confess to this support. But we know from ancient biographies of Horace, but also ancient biographies of other poets of the time, Virgil in particular, that they could become very wealthy, and they were certainly very comfortable because of these gifts that their patrons had given to them.
So that's this life as he enters this extraordinary period as one of the great Roman poets. So let's talk about these works. You talk about him offering a carefully curated self-image within these works, and also poetry in the classical world is one of different genres. There's a kind of hierarchy with the epic at the top. But Horace begins, I suppose, with satire, which is this strange sort of mixture of form and content there, but slightly different perhaps from what we might call satire. What characterises Roman satire, and what's the attraction to Horace, and what makes him so good at it?
Yes, okay. So, I mean, Roman satire, or the main form that Roman satire took, which Horace writes, is a poetic form. That's one respect in which it's rather different from our general conception of satire. Mm. I think what's specifically a little bit unfamiliar about Horace's satire is that his great predecessor in satire, a man of sort of 70, 80, 90 years earlier called Gaius Lucilius, he certainly had a reputation for being fairly aggressive and critical, which we'd recognise as satirical characteristics. Horace's satire claims to be a poetry of kind of moral improvement, of criticism of vice, and such things. So it retains some of that, but it's very, very mild indeed, and seemed to contemporaries to be regarded as extremely mild compared to what Lucilius got up to, and what later satirists, perhaps Juvenal is the most famous of those, how they attacked vices. Horace is a much sort of softer moral guidance that he offers.
And one of many fascinating insights in your book, Llewellyn, was this idea of Roman poets, Horace having this conversation with tradition. In a way, he's building on the past, going back to the Greeks in what he's doing. There's very much a kind of historical sense of a tradition that he's part of and that he's developing, or he's in some kind of conversation with.
Yes, indeed, and this applies with all his poetry. In the case of satire, Lucilius is great model, and he spends quite a lot of time in the first book of two books of satires discussing his relationship to Lucilius. Lucilius was a very significant figure for Romans. More than just the author of satires, he'd become an embodiment of Roman, a very important Roman principle of libertas, we could translate that freedom, but it also means freedom of speech, or ability to speak your mind, which was regarded by the Romans as a kind of a key characteristic of a Roman citizen. With his other works as well, I mean, in his lyric poetry, he's looking more to Greek models, same in his iambic poetry, which is a related form. But in each case, there's a what we would consider a very conservative approach to writing literature, insofar as you have to acknowledge your predecessors, and you have to sort of justify your own contribution to a long tradition. But the other thing to say is that those predecessors, whether they're Lucilius or lyric poets like Alcaeus or iambic poets like Archilochus, come with characters and associations which enrich Horace's poetry and give an extra dimension to Horace's poetry. Sometimes in a similar way, doing similar things to what Lucilius is bringing to his poetry, or the model of Lucilius is bringing to his poetry.
And we shouldn't be surprised by this familiarity with Greek and the Greek world, because he's from southern Italy, where Greek is still very widely spoken at this point. And he's also been schooled in Athens as well. Part of his education took place there, didn't it?
Yes, indeed. And it's significant that he and all the other very well, I was going to say the other posh men. He's posh younger men, young men. He's not a particularly posh young man, but he's there in Athens with, you know, Cicero's son and various other people from the very sort of high elite in Rome. And the fact that they do their finishing at Athens tells you a great deal about Roman culture in general and Roman literary culture. It's not just that Horace comes from the south of Italy and so knows this material. He can be confident that the people who are reading his poetry will be aware of various significant figures from the past, certainly Lucilius, but also the Greek poets like Alcaeus and Sappho and Archilochus. I think the real truth is that the readership that he's primarily writing for are terrifically sophisticated in the reading that they're familiar with, and a sophisticated Roman reading is one that is as much Greek as it is Latin.
And despite your obvious admiration for Horace, his work, you don't shy away from the way he might be problematic for a 21st century audience. There's one critic who calls him the most brutally sexist of the Augustan poets, and he seems, as we shouldn't be surprised by this, but he's very comfortable with the concept of slavery, for example, which is quite ironic given his proximity to it.
Yes, that's right. And the critic that that you quoted there on his sexism is Robin Nisbet, who was responsible for some of the most important scholarship on Horace in recent times. So managed to, you know, be aware of that aspect of Horace, but appreciate his poetic skill at the same time. It is because I suppose Horace at least pretends to be introducing one to his everyday life. It's a very carefully presented view of his everyday life. But because he does, you see rather more perhaps of the everyday practicalities of a Roman life, and particularly the life of somebody in the Roman elite. And slavery is absolutely essential to that. I just draw attention in the book actually to a moment at the end of one of his, you know, I'd say one of his loveliest poems. It's a letter to a friend comparing life in the countryside to life in the city. And at the end of it, he kind of signs off and he says where he's composing this poem. But the verb that he uses is a verb meaning dictation. So he says, I was dictating this poem. And you don't hear, you don't have a slave identified there, but there must have been a slave who was writing down what he was saying, if you take that circumstance literally at all. And he certainly would have had slaves writing down what he's saying. And I think what's most striking about that moment is not just that there is a slave there, but the slave is completely anonymous. The slave is just implied by that verb. And that somebody who was of slave ancestry could be so comfortable with slavery is something to ponder, I think.
Now, looking at genres again, I think it's fair to say that Horace is most famous for his odes. Perhaps his least popular works are the epodes. I wonder if you could explain what they are.
Yes, it's not straightforward. But the epodes are in a genre that's called iambus or iambus, and it's a form of poetry that's associated with, in particular, with two Greek poets from many centuries beforehand, Archilochus and Hipponax. It's a really rough genre, iambus. It's like satire. It's a genre of criticism. It is associated with extremely earthy subjects and language. It's got a strong line in extreme misogyny. So Robin Nisbet was thinking about moments in the Epodes, in particular, when he accused Horace of being spectacularly sexist. I suggest in the book, and I'm not obviously not alone here, that I talk of it as a poetry of crisis. It's a poetry that is very city, or can be very city based, and is suggestive of a city in crisis, morally and politically in crisis. Horace is writing in this form as we approach the Battle of Actium that you mentioned earlier, the ultimate crisis of the Roman civil wars. So he's adopting a form of poetry here, which is rather true to the sort of intense circumstances as Rome reaches the climax of this war.
And you use a lovely phrase in there. You call it that they're characterised by a motley gathering, which I suppose is what a city is a motley gathering. And they're quite pessimistic. They reflect a pretty bleak worldview that I suppose reflects that great crisis in Rome.
They do. There's a iambic poetry and the lyric poetry that he goes on to write in the Odes have certain things in common, though. And I mean, one thing that they have in common is they're associated with the gathering of friends to socialize, to drink. That was a feature of archaic Greek poetry, which Horace is mimicking in both genres. So this is more obvious in the Odes, but in the Epodes too, as well as the sense of crisis, you also have intimations, fairly subtle intimations, but intimations of friendship and cohesion and the possibility of a positive outcome to these dire circumstances. And in the first at the beginning of the first poem, for example, you have Horace associating himself with Mycenas and associating Mycenas with Augustus and talking about them as friends of each other, you know, a cohesive group who might promise a positive outcome. Another thing I'd say about iambic poetry is, I mean, to pick up on what you said and about the Epodes, it's true that the Epodes don't really feature in the general perception of Horace such as it is in more recent times. And it's a shame. It's completely understandable, but it's a shame as well, because the Epodes introduce you to an extremely peculiar cultural phenomenon. Iambic poetry is I think it's the most interesting of the genres that most intrinsically interesting of the genres that Horace follows.
Well, you certainly make the case for them. Let's move now to the genre that contains his best known works, or most of his best known works. The Odes, which I suppose is this culmination of this transposition to Rome of this rich Greek tradition. You suggest that they're characterised by a kind of, they're very economical, they're very efficient in the way that they work, they're well honed. What do you think characterises them?
It's very tricky to answer that question. Very tricky indeed to write a very short chapter in a very short introduction on Horace's Odes,
because I can imagine
so many poems and they're so diverse. But I think you'd say that it's lyric poetry, but that means something a little bit different again from what we generally associate with with the term. What Horace meant was that it was poetry imitating Greek poetry that had been composed to be sung to the lyre, to the lyre. And that meant that, well, there were quite a few poets, Greek poets, that would encompass, but the prominent ones for him are Alcaeus and Sappho and Anacreon. Ooh, how to summarize things. at the core of Horace's odes is the idea of the symposium, is the idea of the drinking party. I suppose one way of thinking about the odes is that they concern themselves with the kinds of things that might come up in the context of a drinking party, of a collection of men who know each other coming together and singing and drinking and such like. So what tends to happen in the odes is, well, a range of things, but there might be hymns, there might be strong assertions of life advice, there might be consolation for the death of a friend. I think what the odes are most remembered for are those pithy statements of eternal human truths, those encapsulations of the things that we should do in order to live good lives. If you can see how, I'm not sure I've done it here, but if you can see how those might emerge, as it were, from the drunken circumstances of a party between males, then you can see what the odes amount to.
Of course, they contain perhaps his most famous, or certainly one of his most famous lines in the first book of Odes, number 37. We have, "Now we must drink."
Yes.
After Actium, of course. But, you know, these are very, very famous lines, and there seems quite a bacchanalian spirit to them as well.
Yes, that's right. I mean, a lot of contemporary circumstances are approached through the condition of the drinking party. So what we're hearing about in that poem in 137, "Nunc est bibendum," why do we have to drink? Well, we have to drink because Cleopatra has been defeated. And there are other points again where, I mean, there's a poem I talk about at some length in that chapter, addressed to a chap called Pompeius, who's finally come back to Rome after fighting against Augustus or various forms. Again, what are Horace and Pompeius doing? They are drinking together. They are celebrating his return through drink and celebration.
And it's a deeply moving poem, isn't it? That's in the second book, isn't it? Number 7,
yeah,
I think.
It's
a wonderful poem. But one of them, you talked about this, the lyre there, this musical instrument. One of them is actually written to be sung, isn't it?
Yes. It's a very interesting state of affairs. So Augustus is engaged in a very, very tricky exercise from the Battle of Actium onwards. He's trying to establish an administration in Rome that will sort of gain general assent and will allow Rome to escape consistently, you know, from the civil wars that have been affecting it for many, many years. In 17 BC, he holds a very, very elaborate ceremony called the Ludi Saeculares, which you could translate as the Games of the Century. They're not really games in our sense. They're a sort of series of religious rituals which are kind of expressive of a new beginning, the end of one period of time and the beginning of a new period of time. Horace writes a long lyric poem for performance at the heart of the of the secular games of the ludi seculares, and it's a remarkable thing, actually. I mean, none of his other odes were written to be sung. Their models in Greek poetry were at least theoretically for singing, but his lyric poems are poems in books. Here he is producing a poem to be sung, and we know, because we have an inscription which tells us this, that it was sung twice and sung by a combined choir of 27 boys and 27 girls. A moment when Horace really becomes the laureate of Rome. Virgil has died by this point. He died a couple of years earlier. Ovid is a different kind of poet, really. Horace's commission to compose this poem for Augustus's terrifically important ceremony is a sign that he's become the most significant cultural figure within Rome.
And in fact, he wrote in one of his odes the line, "I shall not entirely die." So he's sort of got this afterlife from then on, but not before he's created almost a really innovative, unprecedented genre, which we call the epistles, effectively letters in verse, but not really letters.
No, indeed. And throughout Horace's literary career, you can say a version of that. Satire is supposed to be kind of conversation at dinner, I suppose, but his satires aren't really conversation at dinner. And odes are meant to be songs, but they're not really songs. And his letters aren't really letters. His epistles are the collection that after the odes he's been most famous for, I think, most celebrated for, I think it's fair to say. They have a certain amount in common with the odes. They also offer life advice in a rather more expansive form, but they're beautiful poems. The epistles, they're typically aimed at kind of younger men in Rome and in Roman kind of politics and administration, and they, broadly speaking, offer advice to these younger figures to get on in their lives. That hardly captures the character of the collection, but there's a great warmth coming from a figure, Horace, who's sort of defining himself as somebody who's now sort of retired from everyday Roman events, and is in a position to offer advice to people who are still in the rat race, and does so with sort of enormous warmth and subtlety. Even when he's criticizing these figures, he does so with remarkable warmth, I think is the best way of putting it.
Yeah, he seems more confident in his own skin by this time. He is established. He is, as you say, you know, the closest Rome has to a national poet. You know, he's pretty at ease, one gets the sense of with these. But how were these works preserved? He seems to be one of these classical figures who has sustained popularity and influence throughout the period since his death. How was it preserved? How were the works preserved themselves? And how were they disseminated? How influential were they?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. This from the beginning. I mean, how does a collection of poetry, let's say the first book of Horace's epistles, how does it reach the readership, and how does it survive beyond that time? And how can Horace be so confident that his poetry will live forever, for that matter? It's the transmission of Roman poetry is very much to do with the exercise of copying. So texts would be copied both privately and potentially professionally. There were sort of book dealers who would have slaves, you know, copying books. But there would also be sort of private copying. There was no control about where how books might be copied and where they might go. And the survival of Horace's poetry is, you know, essentially an extension of that circumstance. The survival of any classical poetry depends upon a consistent copying, a copying that maintains the thread of manuscripts. And Horace, comparatively speaking, is a well copied poet. All his sort of significant compositions seem to have been sort of consistently copied through antiquity and then into the Middle Ages and beyond. Certain other authors are not, well, lots of other authors that we don't have weren't so successful, but even authors we have, the witness to the text is rather less full than we get with Horace. But it is as simple as that. It's that people consistently copied out all his works and thus created a text that could in turn be copied.
And he's there very influential on the first great Christian poet, 5th century, Prudentius. We talked about his huge importance during the Enlightenment. I read a passage in praise of Horace by Pope, Alexander Pope, in the introduction there. And you make the point as well that there are, well, during the age of nationalism, various Horace's emerged that are English, that are French, that are Italian. Each country has its own version of Horace in a way when it comes to translation. But I think also interesting is the way that Horace has unified people. And I suppose there's that mythical moment when Patrick Leigh Fermor and Heinrich Kreiper meet on Crete in 1942, Kreiper being the captive of Leigh Fermor, and they share that passage from Horace, you know, "You see how Mount Socrates stands bright white in deep snow," and so they're in the Cretan wilderness, which is memorable in every possible way. And I suppose there is something about Horace as well. There's a point you make about how memorable he is. There is something about his poetry that people remember.
Yes, indeed, and I mean, just to go back a bit there, because it's an important thing you draw out there, that that you could have, you know, Polish Horaces and Italian Horaces and British Horaces and you name it. But what that means also is that Horace is a point where Poles can meet Italians, can meet the English, and you know, German captive generals can meet Paddy Leigh Fermor too. I have a former student I'm very proud of who found some, which I mentioned this in the book. Not that I'm very proud of her, but it comes through, I think. She found some poetry by a Spanish sort of Renaissance figure with which he's communicating with people throughout Europe, modeling himself on Horace, knowing that will be recognized by other people around and Europe, and it's a passport to you know, engaging with people from different places. That's partly Latin, you know, but Horace is the kind of is the real key. Yes, memorability is very much what we associate with Horace. My dad many years ago used to he did a bit of Latin when he was a grammar school boy, and it's true to, it's fair to say, didn't emerge a big fan of Horace. And he's thinking about the odes in particular, because he says, you know, his word order was just ridiculous. I mean, you have words sort of thrown all over the place. He was right that Horace, when he's writing these the odes, which are written in sort of Greek metrical forms, which are very kind of restrictive forms, exploits the capacity of Latin to be very, very flexible in word order. It means a lot of things. It means that imitating Horace is very hard if you want to imitate Horace in writing Latin. It does mean, though, that in that he's a good poet to remember, because it's like putting a jigsaw puzzle back together in your head. A stanza of the Odes is, by virtue of its peculiar word order, actually quite a good thing to remember. Now, the other thing about his memorability is that he's a genius at encapsulating something in two, three, four, five, maybe even six words. And his entry in the Oxford Book of Quotations is absolutely enormous because of all these memorable statements: nil desperandum and carpe diem and so on. So I'm pondering that one, actually. It's probably clear that I'm not totally fixed on what I think about it. But you're absolutely right that memorability and Horace are very closely associated thing.
Well, thank you, Llewellyn. That's a great survey of this great poet. And I can't think of a better introduction than Llewellyn Morgan's very short introduction to Horace. It's just £8.99, published by Oxford University Press. It's a bargain if ever there was one, and I highly recommend it to you. And it really is an excellent gateway to this fascinating Roman poet. So thank you, Llewellyn. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.